will increase your efficiency 20% if you learn to do the tough things first, the ones you don't want to do.
Ray Zinn now imparts his management philosophy in Tough Things First. In this series, Zinn covers it all, from the essence of human happiness.
If you're going to make it a consistent practice of working Saturdays just because you think you've got to work 80 hours a week to be successful, you're just flat out wrong.
To the downside of venture capital.
People said, well, don't sweat the small things. Well, I guarantee if you don't sweat the small things, the big things are going to become a mess.
And the essence of entrepreneurial discipline.
Don't want to wait until you jump off the cliff to grab a parachute.
Now here's Ray Zinn, Silicon Valley's longest serving CEO.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the second History of Silicon Valley. This is Ray Zinn, the founder and author of Tough Things First. And we're so delighted to have you join us again. As I mentioned on our previous podcast, we're going to be discussing the history of Silicon Valley. So those of you who are interested in Silicon Valley, you're going to enjoy these podcasts. Thanks for joining us. And this is our second in our series of podcasts. If you missed our first one, you can go to our website, Tough Things First, and pick it up. And we would suggest you start from the beginning. So if you're a newcomer to this series, please go back and then listen to them all in sequence. Otherwise, it'll be a little confusing. I have my good friend, financial advisor, Pete Marchetti, who is joining us today as our moderator for our Tough Things First Silicon Valley History Series. And so welcome again, Pete. So happy to have you.
Thanks again for having me, Ray. I'm looking forward to continuing our series of talks.
Where we left off was I started in 1963. I had left United Technology and joined this new fledgling six-year-old company called Fairchild Cameron Instrument in Mountain View, California.
Yeah, thanks, Ray. Well, I mean, last podcast ended with you talking about how you became aware of Fairchild from your father-in-law. And, you know, he kind of sold you on the idea of working at the company, and you go there. And I guess, you know, it would be great to hear a little bit about what Fairchild represented back then, because I think, you know, and nowadays we all talk about other semiconductor companies, but not as much about Fairchild. It had a kind of outsized importance in terms of the development of Silicon Valley, right? And what it meant for the evolution of the area in the industry. And so could you talk a little bit about like where Fairchild was at that time and how important it was? And maybe a little bit about how it began.
Dr. Shockley left Bell Labs, and he had a group of scientists, people that he brought with him to the Bay Area, and primarily in the Palo Alto area. And again, just to rehearse, Dr. Shockley is from Bell Labs in, I think, Pennsylvania, where they were, again, developing very high-tech processes. And so there was a group of men, they were called the Traitors. They split away from Shockley and formed a Fairchild. And Pete's going to have to help me remember all these people's names because he has that list in front of him. But there was Dr. Robert Noyce, who was the CEO and president of a Fairchild. So what back just to kind of a quick rehearse on that, Fairchild Cameron Instrument was a company back in Maine, I think, or somewhere around there. And they made cameras and other kind of instrumentation. And so that name, Fairchild Cameron Instrument, actually was nothing related to semiconductors, or more related to cameras and instrumentation, more like a Hewlett Packard kind of a company. But anyway, they helped start or fund Fairchild Cameron Instrument, is what it was called back in the late 50s, early 60s. And I had joined them in 1963, where they had only been in business for 6 years. And so there's Dr. Noyce, Robert Noyce, Gordon Moore, Jay Last, John Hornay, Julius Blank, Andy Grove, and who else did I miss?
We have Victor Greenwich, Sheldon Roberts.
Okay, and then...
And Andy Grove, just for clarification, Andy Grove came in later, right?
That's right. He was from Israel. So let's see.
Eugene Kleiner, too.
Eugene Kleiner, which ultimately became Kleiner Perkins, a venture capital company. Okay, so those were what they called the traitorous traitorous eight because they left board Dr. Shockley. And they had developed this planar process, silicon planar process. And so that was the first time that we'd actually done planar technology. And that was a major patent allowing us to move to more of a planar technology, which is really the heart and soul of making integrated circuits is a planar process. But we didn't start out with integrated circuits. An integrated circuit means that you combine more than one transistor on the same piece of silicon. That's why they call it integrated, because you're integrating multiple transistors on the same piece of silicon. So silicon is a material that is like glass, basically, or sand. And it starts as a little seed. They take a seed crystal and then they grow that crystal in a cylindrical way, so it looks like a big ingot of silicon. And then they after they grow it, it's a single crystal, no separations. It was one single crystal of silicon, and then they sliced it in these very thin slices. And back in the day when I started, they were only 3/4 inch in diameter. Now they're well over 12 inches in diameter per wafer. And so that's a little primer on what silicon is. And so we had to make all of our own equipment to process these wafers. And so we had two divisions that actually made in Fairchild that made the equipment. And then a division and made some test equipment. So, because we had to test this product, these fellows that we just mentioned were part of Fairchild. They were kind of the heart and soul in the beginning of the semiconductor industry in Silicon Valley, located on Wispin Road in Mountain View, which is just right off the freeway from Highway 101, and that's kind of how. That kind of got started as far as the facilities.
What was it like to work there at that time? I mean, you're a young man, recently married, and what was the culture at Fairchild like and kind of how exciting was the environment, I guess, during that time when things were being developed and invented at such a rapid pace?
We were all kind of, except for the research group up in Palo Alto, the Fairchild Research Group, which Gordon Moore ran, and John Hernay and Vic Greenwich were up there. But down in Mountain View at the manufacturing facility, it was a small building. It wasn't huge. I think it was like 30 or 40,000 square feet originally. So it's a small building. We were all kind of jammed together there. I mean, we were literally elbow to elbow in that building because the company was growing extremely rapidly. So you have to remember back in that time, the major customer was the military because no one could really afford to pay thousands of dollars for a transistor because the way that the electronics was done before you had the semiconductor was tubes. Inverion made tubes, and as well as GE and other Westinghouse made these electronic systems out of tubes. A tube was had a glass bulb on it and a connector on top and some pins coming out the bottom and so it was called a vacuum tube, and so that was the way that electronics originally done was with tubes. If you remember, well, you won't, none of you probably remember this, but we had tube radios. I mean, a radio might consist of one or two tubes to run the radio, and it was quite clunky and drew a lot of power. In comes the transistor, or the planar transistor that we made at Fairchild, that cost hundreds of dollars and upwards over $1,000 just for a 3-liter device, because it was all new and the process was difficult to control, and so it was a very expensive technology, but the government was the primary customer. I think probably 80 to 90% of the revenue came from government contracts. And so almost all the products that I worked on back in the early 60s were all military products.
On that, Ray, what sort of things was the government using the chips or the semis for, the transistors for? What were the end uses?
Primarily instrumentation for airplanes, because we needed, you know, the tubes were big and heavy. And so the transistor was small, very, very tiny. I mean, very tiny, the size of your fingernail back in those days. And so we could cram a lot more electronics in the airplane or in the equipment, the military equipment. Well, they had it also in some of the armament, like tanks and so forth, but and on ships, but primarily airplanes, because airplanes needed the light weight. And so and then of course we were in the middle of the Sputnik and the race to the moon and satellites and that sort of thing. So NASA, which was right next door to us, which also was another reason why Silicon Valley took off, was because you had NASA there, and NASA was one of the biggest customers for electronics for these space devices like satellites. And so it's because of the lightweightness of the transistor that allowed these satellites to be put in orbit.
Right. I remember reading something about the government spend as it related to NASA in the space race, and how incredible the spending was during that almost entire decade, and really helped to kind of push the semiconductor industry.
Oh yeah. If it weren't for the U.S. government, military primarily, the industry would never have taken off. So it's primarily the military cut contracts that really, sprung to life and got the industry up and running. So, the players now that we need to talk about, of course, because they've become more of the history of Silicon Valley, are the people like Dr. Bob Noyce, Dr. Gordon Moore, Dr. Andy Grove, Victor Greenwich, and now there's another character that came on the scene. His name is Charlie Spork, which we'll talk about him pretty soon, and Jerry Sanders. So those are going to be important names going forward in our conversation. So again, probably a good place to end this particular podcast, and then we'll move on to the next one. We hope everybody will join with us, and it'll be exciting. So we're really only up to about 1964 in the series. So we've only covered a couple of years. There's a lot of interesting stories, a lot of good things that you're going to get to hear about the industry if you're going to want to follow this podcast. So again, thanks, Pete, for hosting this one. And I'm doing most of the talking, because I guess I'm the one that has the history.
It wouldn't be very exciting, Ray, if I did any talking here.
Well, probably the oldest living survivor of the industry yet on Earth. So.
Yeah, well, I mean, your combination of experience, and as I mentioned to you many times, your ability to recollect, that combination is really powerful. It's a great thing for everybody else to be able to tap into and learn from. So, again, I'm better off being quiet, and you're better off talking.
Well, thanks again for having this series with me. So thanks again, everyone, for joining us today for this second in the series of History of Silicon Valley. Please join us as we go forward with our third, fourth, fifth, and sixth, however long it's going to take us to complete this series. Please join our website, toughthingsfirst.com. You can pick up my book, Tough Things First, at Amazon or other local book retailers, or my new book, Zen of Zen, which is a philosophical book that'll help you in your everyday life. So again, thanks, Pete, for joining us, and thanks for all of you for following our podcast.
You've been listening to Tough Things First, candid talk with Silicon Valley's longest-serving CEO, Ray Zinn. Drop by the contact page at toughthingsfirst.com for more about the book, more podcasts, and links to Ray's Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn pages to keep up with Ray Zinn's wisdom daily.